All right, you know what's the worst thing for a speaker? There's two things that are really bad for a speaker. One is a near empty room, and one is a room with people standing in the back, because the expectation is so high. And if there is some of you who are standing right now are gonna leave. It's like, oh, I'm getting tired. This guy is speaking like, what the hell? And then we kind of, you know, just go, you know, the talk. So stakes are high, but I have the cutest email in the world. Look at that. All right, so I'm very honored to be at the first edition of CBBCon, which looks absolutely awesome. What, hands up if you liked the conference so far? All right, there's always time to disappoint. So I'll ask after this talk and let's see. So I'll get right into it. I have some tips regarding optimization for all of us, things that surprised me quite a bit. I talked about optimization in the past, and I derived quite a few insights from my work on HHVM at Facebook. HHVM is our JIT compiler for PHP and Hack, and it's a high-profile product at Facebook. We open sourced it recently. It's a high-profile product in the sense that every 1% that it does better, it's going to save the company a lot of money in terms of power and in terms of acquisition of hardware. So only power cost can be a high figure. To that end, there's going to always be people who do care about that extra oomph that they get from hardware. It's like, you know, the B-list actors versus the A-list actors. There are actors on the B-list that are pretty good. They're not just there. And everybody wants to see the A-list actors. Same here. You know, we could have used second-rate techniques. And we got so far so sophisticated, things like linker scripts and the oddest, you know, the oddest tricks imaginable, including some you're going to see today. So inlining. Inlining is one odd optimization because it essentially enables and interacts with all others. All optimizations interact with one another, but inlining is sort of the first step in a long list of optimizations. Once you inline code, then a lot of things start to happen. A lot of code gets exposed, white box, and then other optimizations start kicking in. So it's not surprising that once you do one stage of inlining, what's going to happen next is many other optimizations are going to kick in. And the code at the end of the whole process is going to look like nothing like the inline function. Who's kind of familiar with this kind of stuff? Did you ever disassemble code and stuff? I'm in the right place. Fantastic. All right, the last hand, Nevin. Perfect. So it's very hard to estimate, and it's very hard for a compiler writer to say, here's my cost function for a line. Here's the cost function that makes me decide whether or not I'm going to inline a function and subsequently inline transitively other functions inside of it, right? And there's kind of an interesting thing that when you benchmark compiler speed, you often benchmark on a micro benchmark, a small benchmark, on a small application, or media application at most. And you know, the estimates that you get from benchmarking the performance of your inliner are going to be quite different from what you see in a finalized application. So far, so good? All right, here's a tip. This is not an essential tip, but it's kind of a small tip. It's a micro tip. We took a long time at Facebook to migrate from GCC 4.7 to GCC 4.8. Because GCC 4.8 had like a horrible like 5% regression in performance. And 5% is like just, you know, it's in the millions. It's just a huge regression for us. And until we kind of, you know, got to discuss about it, and I was like, oh, actually there's quite a few things that control the inlining in GCC. And once you pass these parameters to GCC 4.8, you get a win instead of a loss. We get a 2% win. So this was 7% difference on a large application. Just to show you how sensitive the inliner is to a variety of parameterization and tweaking. And tweaks do matter. You know, I mentioned this in the past. Tweaks do matter. So it's many people think, oh, I get it to the proof of concept stage, and then tweaking is going to give me like 10% more or 50% more. Actually, tweaking can get to 50x more, right? Can get to a lot, so tweaking does matter. All right, so let's sort of getting into it, and this is gonna kind of put the aligning on the spot. There's some dark matter going on in every C++ program, which is constructors and destructors. So, first of all, you know, one bad thing about constructors and destructors is that everybody says they're good, right? That was a joke. I was kidding here. You know, contrasts, it's a humor technique. Seinfeld, I don't know. So everybody says they're good. Motherhood and apple pie, so you should define constructors and destructors. You rely on constructors and destructors. RAII, all that good stuff. So they are kind of good in a way that the programming technique is good for a variety of sort of quality reasons. However, it turns out quite surprisingly, at least to me, it was that constructors and destructors are a major enemy when they ally with inlining for your code size, right? So the way it goes is, well, you write constructors and it's destructors, and often they're going to be implicitly generated without you even kind of, you gotta think a bit about it. Because you have for example, you have a struct, and it's, oh, it's a struct, it's, you know, I didn't write any constructor, but at some point you change a char star to a string, and all of a sudden a member of the struct has a constructor and the destructor, and all of a sudden the struct itself is bestowed with a constructor and a destructor. Am I making sense? Right? Okay. So all of a sudden we have this transitive effect. Like, you know, you have one, you know, we have one drop of, it's like homeopathy, right? You have one drop of good stuff in a well of water, and the more water there is, the worse it gets. I mean, the better it gets. You know, there's this joke about you put a drop of like dirt, and the homeopathic effect would be disastrous, because if you reach the ocean, that drop is going to be a disaster, right? It's the reverse of homeopathy. So anyhow, it's the same with members, right? Pretty much the same. The way it goes is, once you have a member that has a constructor and destructor, a bunch of stuff is going to generate from it and transitively to the structures that contain it. So it gets worse from here, because very often these are automatic generators. So the compiler has complete control over it. It's completely white box. The compiler is going to be able to inline those guys. And it's like, oh, so I have this guy. So what's a few stores between friends there? You know, with a Russian accent, you know, that'll be perfect, right? So, you know, just a few stores there. You know, we're going to store a few things and whatever it costs. So, but then it gets bigger, and it's kind of a boiling frog kind of effect. And you get to the point where, so all of these implicitly generated constructors and destructors that are trivial, and what happens then is you have your code, the code that you're looking at, contains dark matter in the interstices, right? Contains a bunch of stuff that you didn't write. You kind of have to think that it even exists, and it's kind of present everywhere. And it gets worse because it's inlined. So there's a lot of fat, you know, that bad, like, brown fat or whatever the bad fat is, right? You have all that stuff in between the interstices of your code, in between the lines. There's code going on, and there's code and code. And that has really bad effects at scale. I'll kind of get a bit into detail on that. But that goes beyond traditional advice, because the traditional advice is, well, don't overcopy objects. So you don't want to copy too many objects. You don't want to kind of overdo it. You want to avoid. You want to use R-value references. You want to pass by reference, all that good stuff. But it's not only that. It gets worse because, for example, nobody advises you to not write destructors. Well, you gotta write it because it's there, right? However, these destructors, once present and once inlined, they increase your code size sometimes considerably. So I promise I'll get into detail about why that is bad. Why is it bad to have bad code? It turns out that the major liability at HHVM, and I suspect that many other major projects, is iCache spills. iCache is the instruction cache. And the way diecache works is like just like any cache, you load the instructions into it, except it's read-only. So it's some way there's less pressure in it than a traditional data cache. So you load instructions into diecache, you execute them, and every once in a while you're going to have to jump elsewhere and load some other stuff into the cache, and you're going to have to evict the cache, all that good stuff, right? Cache. And in micro benchmark, you're not going to see iCache, because micro benchmark is not going to be like, oh, let me write the 1 million lines of benchmark, right? Nobody's going to do that, right? So micro benchmarks are not going to exercise many iCache effects. They're going to, you know, look at like the, you know, itsy bitsy stuff and all that good stuff. And, you know, now here's the thing. You're a compiler writer. What you're going to do, are you optimized for those two customers who have big programs? How much money can they give you? Hey, optimize for the, want to have good benchmarks, so they look good in articles, right? You aren't jumped in. No, I'm serious, actually. That was not a joke. And this wasn't. What? Okay. So this is like negative day for me. So, you know, you want to look good. You want to, you want to outdo the competition. And you want to satisfy many of your customers, right? Nobody's going to say, well, I'm going to write a compiler that's going to work great for Google and Facebook only. And the hell with the rest. Because they don't matter, right? I mean, nobody's going to do that. So therefore, sorry?
Google might.
Good one. All right, so it's kind of difficult to say, you know, what am I measuring this compiler against? I have to add some sort of a recent, the phantom bullet here. You know, we open source HHVM, and a lot of good software is open sourced. So I think there's a good trend, because it means compiler writers are going to be able to say, well, you know, GCC, the newer GCC can actually test against HHVM and other large programs and say, am I doing well on a large program like that that's realistic and does something interesting? So, you know, I hope that's going to be more of a trend. So tip number one goes simply like this. Beware inline destructors. Beware. It doesn't mean don't do them. I'm not saying you to not do them. I'm saying to be aware of what's costing you. So inline destructors are going to be called everywhere implicitly. As an aside, they add significant code to functions that may throw, because you need to have like the whole cleanup code. That's why it's nice to adorn your functions with no except whenever possible, right? And they're not reflecting the source code in the source code size, and that's a transitive effect, so it gets pretty thick pretty soon. And they're often generated by the compiler, which means the compiler is going to be eager to inline them. Compilers are very eager to inline quite a bit. So therefore, watch the destructor size carefully. And here's a simple thing you can do. I don't have a slide for that, but this is a very simple thing. So, you know, people say, I'm not going to write the destructor because it's actually a tip, I think, in Herb's and my book. Probably we should recant on that. But it's like, you know, you don't need to, if you need to write a destructor, maybe you've done something wrong elsewhere because you're too low level. Ideally, you'd have your members, such as unique pointer and shared pointer and whatnot, vector, whatnot, take care of the destructor for you, and it's generated, and it's called, and everybody's happy. Actually, everybody's not happy. Sometimes it's nice to just declare the destructor in your class, semicolon, right? And then define it in the CPP file such that the compiler does not have easy access to get its grubby little hands on it and inline it. And you define in the, we say, equal default, and you just put the empty braces, and you're good. Right? It's just that you're explicitly saying, you know what? I know you could define this for me, but I'm going to, define it nevertheless. And you go ahead and define in the C++ file. And then, of course, the story goes. It never ends. Link time inlining. You know, it's like we try to punch them here, and they punch us. You know, it never ends. There's no guard. Okay. So then the guys come with link time inlining and say, there it is. And it looks like an empty body. So, what's a few stores between friends, right? All right, so watch the destructor size carefully. And you know, you may want to just disassemble sometimes your destructor and see, you know, how big is this guy and how much does it affect me, right? So beware inline destructors. And just to give you a taste, actually, is this readable at all? No, okay, unanimous. Okay, let me see. I think I can read it. All right. So this is a program we use that essentially there's a team dedicated. It's a big deal. It's a program that we use for assessing performance of our JIT compiler. And essentially, if you inline one destructor, the top line is what matters, and it says this. It says CPU instructions minus 0.3%. CPU time plus 0.4%, which means if I inline one destructor in my large program, one destructor, literally, of one type. It's a widely used type, nevertheless, but you know, I'm cherry picking here, but it's one destructor. And the bottom line effect has been the number of instructions I retire has reduced. Why? There's no more function called sequence, call and return, they're gone. So as a rule, whenever I inline anything, the total number of instructions is going to go down, right? It's gonna go down because there's no more call and return. There's less code, there's fewer instructions to retire. There are more instructions present, but there are fewer instructions to retire, right? Great, so the trace is gonna be smaller. And that's sustained by this test here. So I have minus 0.3%. So I gotta say, like on HGVNT, you see minus 0.3%, you say, this is not good. We're not gonna take that. It's a loss, it's a regression. It's already a regression. Up to like 0.2%, you can say it may be in the noise, or let me repeat the experiment. 0.3 and above is like already no, okay? So, but that's not what matters. You know, it's nice to have fewer instructions because fewer instructions are a good proxy for faster code, you'd think, right? However, somewhat paradoxically at first sight, CPU time has increased by 0.4%, which is definitely in the range of, you know, this is bad, this is a regression. So 0.4% is like, oh, so we're losing a few, you know, quite a bit of money. I can't say the numbers, so you know, I hate that. So we're losing quite a few dollars on just power costs alone and ventilation, all that good stuff. So no, that's a bad thing. So why did the CPU time increase although the CPU instructions decreased? iCache. That's a nice Apple product in the making. iCache. All right. So indeed, although the number of instructions retired has been reduced measurably, considerably, in fact, the total execution time has increased because the memory subsystem spends all that time evicting and loading the instruction cache. So not good. And it's interesting that, again, it's a line of code that I changed in a destructor to actually change all of this stuff. And it's not the semantics I changed. It's just the inlining. As a simple tip, here's how you control inlining on the two, actually three, because GCC and LLVM and Clang do it the same. So GCC and Clang, you say, always inline. Okay, so there's about like four keywords in GCC that control inlining, which kind of underlines the importance of the concept, right, I guess. It's also probably bad design on a few artifacts. But essentially, you got to write inline attribute always inline, just to make sure that it's always inlined. And to tell you the truth, it's not always inlined. I'm not kidding. So it's not, even though you say always in line, it's not always going to be in line. And continuing with GCC, you say never in line, you say attribute no in line. And of course, sometimes it's going to be in line. I'm not kidding. So these things are, even though you say always and never, they mean almost always and almost never. But those are too long to type, so we said whatever. In VC++, you do force inline or decal spec of no inline, and that's the way the cookie crumbles. All right, now here's what I did. I took HHVM, and I defined never inline to be nothing. you know, they call it defanging. You take the fangs off, right? So they can't kind of, you know, they can't do nothing, right? So I defined never inline to be nothing. Well, the effect has been red, which means bad. So I got an increase by 0.9% in instruction count. Why was that? Function call overhead. And I also got a CPU time increase of 1.6%, right? So that's like a huge regression. And you know, mind you, I should add that never inline are hints introduced by engineers. So it's manual work. So this manual work has paid off this much. It's easy to measure. You can say, well, those people who spent hours doing that have gained 1.6% in CPU time. And now let's do the other. Let's defang always in line. So let's make always in line do nothing. And with that, we're going to get indeed a reduction of CPU instructions by 0.2%, but we're going to get an increase of CPU time of 0.8%. So both actually make things worse if you ignore them. So sometimes it's better to inline stuff, sometimes it's better to not inline. And it's essentially, at this point, it's a hard enough problem that you need to take control in your hands and measure and assess how you address it. All right. And now I'm going to discuss all of this construction and destruction and lining issue. I'm going to run a simple case study, which is like a sort of a user-defined shared pointer. You know, it's, shared pointers have been such a popular topic for C++. Everybody has written a couple. You know, there's good understanding of what's going on. So it's sort of a simple example. But keep in mind that the effects at work are more general than that. So shared pointer is the, you know, the obvious solution to reference counting. And it's a shared pointer, in particular, the standard one. It's optimized for a blend of needs. So, well, I want... I want to actually share a pointer among threads without aggravation, right? So therefore, you need to do atomic reference counting. I want to support custom deleters, and I want to support weak pointers so I can break cycles, right? And there's no support for intrusive reference counting. And that's kind of a bad thing because, you know, if you're serious about it, you want to have intrusive reference counting. It's sort of... a good thing for large applications. Now, I've in a past talk, I gave this tip, which is the first cache line is where it's at. What do I mean by that?
In your L1 cache, it's the fastest thing to get to.
Right. So you have a data structure, like a class or a struct, right? And you want to sort the members of that data structure by hotness, meaning you put the most attractive first. Oh, come on. Okay. You put the hottest first, right? So you want to put the most accessed the most often first. And there's often cases in which you just swap a couple of members and you have like a huge increase. Because once you have the address of the object and essentially the first cache line, which is how many bytes? In chorus. 64, thank you very much. Next time you sing it, okay? Just trill a bit. Okay, so 64 bytes, the first 64 bytes of an object is where things happen, where the action goes. And there's a lot of people like, the first member is a bool, like messes up the alignment completely, like, you know, it's a boolean that takes a word actually because of the alignment. And he's like, oh, was initialized. Or something that is test once. You know, it's tested once and that does nothing for the rest of the lifetime. So you want to put the most accessed stuff in your objects at the front of the object. Front load the hotness, right? So guess what? The reference counter is very hot. And often in a shared pointer, if you don't use make shared, it's going to be elsewhere, meaning a completely different cache line, completely different everything, right? Ideally, you would put the reference count right at the front of your object as the first member. So if you can afford intrusive reference counting, that's where we want to be. Make sense? All right. Awesome. So atomics do matter. So I've just been in this great talk about log-free programming. I was I felt vindicated because there's all these people who say, oh, you know, atomic reference, you know, plus, plus, and minus, minus. They're pretty much as good as the, you know, everything else. And they're not. I mean, it's like this. No matter how I measured, I couldn't get any, you know, any faster than 2.5 times, right? And the talk before was like 10 times. I was very happy. Like, okay, so he even overdid me. So I'm very, this is conservative numbers because I didn't want to annoy Herb all that much, who's not here. Okay, great. He's like, you know, I'm not going to go to that talk because I hate that guy. All right. And think of this. Compilers know what plus, plus, and minus, minus do. Compilers have known for 40 years what plus, plus, and minus, minus do. And when they find them in tandem, when they find them next to each other, they know that they're, you know, they cancel each other. And they often take them away, right? It's not the same for atomics. Atomics must be visible because they're, you know, they're shared effect. And you see a fetch and add, and you see a fetch fetch add with plus one and minus one, it's not going to be the same. It's not going to look like they cancel each other. And they're not going to be optimized away. However, Herb, if he were here, he would be bouncing, you know, he would up and down like a guy in the Le Cirque du Soleil because he said, no, actually, Microsoft Compiler does do all that good stuff and et cetera, et cetera. And maybe STL can confirm that. Or... Great. That's the right answer. Okay. So actually, Herb kind of, you know, pushed back on that. So keep that in mind. All right. So, well, how about unwitting sharing? So I want to define a single threaded share point because I can't afford a 2.5 to 10x cost. So therefore, I want to define a, you know, single threaded share pointer. I share, but not across threads kind of thing. So, you know, there's what if I do pass it to another thread? And actually, there is a solution there, which is easy. You just store the thread ID at the first access with a smart pointer, and then you assert on it. You assert that the thread ID of the guy that accesses it is the same as the thread ID that initially created the smart pointer, and you assert on it, and all of that code is just in debug mode, right? And the classic implementation goes, of course, like this. I have like until 4:15. 4:15 is like the, okay, perfect. So I have single thread pointer, and we go with the absolutely classic structure with two words, two pointers. One is pointing to the payload, and that's P. And the other is pointing to the counter, that's C. And all is good. OK, so we initialize with null, whatever. We go, well, if we initialize this guy by one, the reference count is one, right? But if the pointer is null, you're going to also initialize this guy as null. And the copying and everything goes as everybody knows this code. It's fairly trivial. Anything interesting here? You just construct. This is the move construction. It copies the two pointers and resets them right after. And the destructor is going to do the expected things, right? OK. So Herb gave a talk that's available online called Atomic Weapons. And he has a very similar implementation of reference counter pointers, where he has pretty much the code above, except he uses atomic of unsigned star for the counter and uses fetch add and fetch sub for plus, plus, and minus, minus, respectively. Very nice. So our task is, you know, we take this naive implementation, no atomics involved. We share only within the thread, make it faster. Ideas. This is the time where, you know, there's power in numbers. Come on. Group like 10, you know, that row, that side, this side, that, do something. Ideas, how to make this faster? Put the count at the head. Oh, make it intrusive. We can't afford. Let's say we can't afford. It's a good point though. Yes. There was thread local references. Go on. No, you don't. You want to make me work. No, I want you to work. So like, oh, thread local, run with it. You know? So, I don't think I have a... Okay, something else. Ideas. All right, I have an idea. Let's read the paper. Right. So I read this paper, down for the count. which analyzes reference counting, down for the count, a nice pun there. And they look at a number of applications and look at how many, you know, what's the largest reference count you ever get? And this is the actual number of reference counts, like 0, 1, 2, 3, whatever. And they get to the interesting realization that for like 90% of the application doesn't get before above like 3. So most objects have very low reference counts. All right, now that we know that, so you know, there's some insight there, which is interesting. Most objects have very low reference count. What's an idea? Yes, in the back. People in the back are always the best. Come again? Steal some of the bits from the object, from the pointer, and put them, you know, count them as the reference count. You know what? I deleted those slides because this is a 90-minute talk, and I compressed it to 60 minutes. So yes, but there's no slides. It's a good idea, and people do that. You can steal some bits and say up to 16. What do you do above 16? You saturate, you log, and you leak. I mean the program. Just make it right. Saturate. You saturate the counter to 15 or whatever the maximum was. You log the event. You say, you know, here's this this goddamn object. What the hell, right? And then you leak it. You let it be. You never decrement the reference count again. And the application continues to run with the leak and everything. There's a log that witnesses what happened. But the application still behaves normally, still does work, and until you kind of have to reset, because what the hell? That's like 20 gigabytes of RAM for that application, you know? And, you know, this is a fact of life that sometimes you gotta do that. It's a great idea. Thanks for stealing my 4 minutes with this, although I did have no slide. Other ideas? Great. We're starting to get like really interesting here. Ideas? All right, I have one. Yes, Stefan. You could use make-share-like optimization. You could use, yeah. You could use make-share. So that's a sort of applies everywhere and anywhere. Whenever you can, you actually allocate the reference count next to the payload and make the reference count point like one step above, you know, in front of it. And that's all nice because you only do one allocation. So that is great. Whenever you can do it, you should. But what optimization can you derive from this particular fact that very many objects have very low reference count? Fedor.
Well, you can optimize transition 0 to 1.
You can optimize transition 0 to 1. And? 1 to 0. Because, okay, I'm getting somewhere. Okay. That beard will never quit. All right. So let me show you. For example, so we kind of decrement this guy compulsively. So the pointer is not null. And we decrement this guy. Why the heck would you decrement if you know it's 1? Huh. Okay, let's kind of see if I heard that code. I hope I do. All right, so, let me make a few prefatory comments to all that, because I discovered this in our code base at Facebook. You know, people avoided auto-PTR, so it's sort of a fact of life that auto-PTR didn't work out. So then, back then, in the dark ages, before shared PTR, you were like, oh, well, what do I have? Before unique PTR, people are like, what do I have here? Well, I have TR1 shared PTR, boost shared PTR. As a replacement, right? So like, oh, I'm gonna use a shared PTR here, although all I need is a one reference, you know, a unique reference kind of pointer because I don't have the unique PTR thing. So I'm gonna use this guy, even though I know the count is going to be always 1 and 0. I mean, 1 and then going away, right? Interesting, and I did notice that there are designs that just put shared PTR there for future flexibility. Like, well, there is one owner right now, but what if in the future, you know? When that hoverboard, where's the hoverboard in the future? Back to the future, okay. So, you know, for the future, I just put that flexibility in there. Rightly or wrong, it could be right reasons, there could be wrong reasons. It's not my place to discuss that, right? So, okay, interesting. So let's change the code to do, first of all, lazy reference count allocation. We're gonna get to Fedor's idea in a minute. But let's do this. Actually, let's make this. Whenever the counter is null, it means it's really 1. Huh. So I get unique pointer for free. Where's your share pointer? Does your share pointer do that?
I cannot. This is not applicable to the stood share pointer.
Very well. Why?
You want me to explain why? It's because it's multi-threaded and it supports weak pointers. So
weak pointers, right.
If we have double wide atomics, we cannot exclude the possibility of somebody making a weak pointer when we're not looking and then locking it
right.
in a shared pointer.
But every machine has double wide locking.
It's theoretically possible. I've not figured out how to do it yet. I don't know of anybody who has done that.
All right, let the record state that he said it's not impossible. Okay. Anywho, so we're not worrying about weak pointers here, but we are worrying about optimizing this particular single thread pointer. So let's do this. Well, whenever I start with a pointer, I say, well, I'm copying a pointer, and if the counter is not, I'm allocating with two. Nice, because it's already two, because one means really null, right? And otherwise, I'm just going to increment it. And there's a subtlety here, which goes, how about this guy? Why do you think I commented that out and wrote unneeded? Keep in mind, I'm famous for having mistakes in my slides, so that may be a mistake. But it may not be. Why do you think I afforded that? And that's an extra, that's a less of a write, which is a big deal, actually, at scale. Right? It's an, a story. It's a, why is that? Exactly. You have this invariant that says, well, if the payload is null, you don't even look at the counter. So it can be anything. You can leave it actually dangle, which is dangerous but fun, right? Nice. So far, so good. And then we have the destructor, which does exactly what I promised. If the pointer is not null, I'm not looking at anything else. First line. Awesome. And then I have my famous go-to Susumi, so you know, and stuff like that. It makes the code smaller, my friends. I'm not kidding. Try to do this without the go-to, and you know, it's difficult. So it goes back and deletes this guy and whatever, and that kind of stuff. Pretty nice. I'm not above using go-to, if it has an advantage, right? Very nice. So there's an alternative to this. Well, now you need the C. And in this case, you look at the reference counter first, and then you delete both, right? And that's interesting because it folds the test for null into the delete call. As I'm sure you know, if you call delete against the null pointer, it's guaranteed to do nothing. So essentially, it has already a test for nullness inside of it, and this variant exploits that. But now there's a story to that, because if you do an if before the delete, then the code is going to be smaller because maybe you don't call delete. So the call to delete is kind of remote. And you pay the cost of the call, and the test is done inside of delete, which may be an out-of-line function. And so you pay the price for the call even though the pointer is zero. So if the pointer is almost always zero, then you may want to actually not take this path. All right. So the performance dynamics goes like this. If I have one reference, that means the pointer is not null, and the counter is null, or the counter is one. And that means unique reference. How can the counter be ever one? Because remember, I initialized it to two. Decrement. So when I go back, I don't compulsively say, oh, did you get down to two? Then let me kind of, from two to one, then let me delete it and nullify it. Why don't I do that? No. Right, so I don't have to thrash. I don't say, oh, delete, then allocate again. Once you allocate some memory, it's good to kind of hold on to it a bit, right? You pay the cost for it, so you better make some good use of it. You get your money's worth, right? Exactly, thank you. So once you allocate, then you allocate the thing, you initialize that two, but when it goes down from two to one, you don't say, let me just delete this guy because I don't need it. Let me hold on to it, okay? Nice. This is what I just said, and go to, awesome, everything. Constructors get smaller and use zero initialization because I initialize with the null pointers and everything. And I can control the number of copies better than the number of creations. And this is an interesting insight. The number of creations very often is like, I need these objects, so I'm going to, but I can control copies by passing my reference, teasing the raw pointer out of the smart pointer. So I have some control over how many copies of the shared pointer I'm making. But I don't have much as much control over the how many copies I'm creating, right? How many creations, how many objects I'm creating. So that's sort of a nice thing because it indicates that certain functions here are hotter than others. So this is not as hot as, for example, this, because this is it's going to be deleted as many times as it's created. So nice. All right. And tip three, which we get to Fedor's famous beard, which is, well, skip the last decrement. When you get there, you're there, so don't decrement that guy because you're doing a write extra and the write is expensive. The worst thing in computing are indirect writes. I hate them, right? So indirect writes, the anathema, you never want to write indirectly. Just do everything in registers, okay? They do it, yeah. 4 kilobytes took the man on the moon, right? 4 kilobytes, and right now that's like L0 cache, right? It's the register file. Yeah, sure, 4 kilobytes. All right, I was kidding here. So you can use memory, but just don't overuse it, okay? So skip the last decrement. In the destructor here, we're gonna build, instead of saying if minus minus C equals zero, we say, well, just look at that guy and see if it's one. And if it's one, then I know I'm done, so I don't touch it anymore. Big deal. I don't touch it anymore. Big deal. So I'm going to do the whole thing. Skip the last decrement. Any more ideas? OK, let's optimize this even more. Yes? You can cache the read of C, of star C, right? Let's see. If not C, that's loading the pointer. And star, OK. Right. The compiler is going to do it. But you know, it's a sort of a good point. You want to disassemble this code and look at it, literally. You want to look at this code and say, well, was this loaded into a register and kept around until this decrement, right? But it's a good point. This is a sort of micro-optimization. But you know, how about something more interesting? Yes?
Could you shift all the counts down by one so that you can make your comparison against 0 instead of 1?
Why do I want to make a comparison against 0, my
because
fair friend?
Uh-huh.
Yes. All right, starting to blow myself here. Yes. You want zeros. Why do you want zero? No. I mean sometimes. The instructions are going to be smaller. So did we just talk about that? Let me kind of skip ahead a bit. Right. I'm going to go back because we got into this. What's wrong with you? OK, so zero is special. Special assignments, so I mentioned this already, so I'm just going to kind of punt a bit on it. But essentially, zero is special. There's a lot of places where zero is produced, and you know, for example, on a RISC machine, how do you produce a zero? You XOR a register with itself, right? And it's just gonna be zero. So how do you load those? So that's how you load the zero. How do you compare against zero?
Okay.
You have a test, it's already there, so you don't need to compare it. How do you compare it against one? Oh, wait, I have a constant in instruction stream. That iCache is expensive. So I don't want to load the constant in instruction stream, which is one, and kind of load it and look at it and compare and all that stuff, right? That's hard work. I just want to say test and be done with it. So it's very special. It's very nice. And in Anini, we want to make zero the most frequent value. Let me see if I have this link here. Yeah, I have this link. You know what? I'm gonna take a risk here and load this link. But before that, let me explain what I mean. So I'm going to load this link and see if the whole infrastructure works here. So a weird sub-tip would be, well, make default state all zeros, because zeros are nice. And I want the default state of my objects to be all zeros, because then the compiler detects that and is going, this is a zero. I can use a special mem set or a special load or whatever. And to wit, I have this example for you. Oh, God, make it work. Oh, OK. Allow, I guess. All right. OK, this doesn't look good. OK. Can anyone see any of this? Probably not, right?
Yeah.
Oh, OK, good. Great. So OK, that doesn't help much. All right, so I have struct point 0 here. Let me highlight the code that I'm kind of pointing at. I have struct point zero, which initializes very naively. It says point zero, the default constructor initializes x by zero, y by zero, and z by zero. Very nice. And the actual routine that uses point zero is going to look like this. Bam. Took source, return. Because it returns, the fun returns a point. Let me show you the function. This returns a default constructed point, right? And the content of the function is like three instructions. Took source, two XORs, and the red. Very small. And then I have a point, thank you. And then I have a point one, which says, well, let me initialize them to minus one because I'm a bad guy. And I want, you know, and I want to initialize them by minus one. And then I'm writing a routine that's going to gun, be called gun, and return point one. And gun looks completely different and a lot larger. In reality, it looks only one instruction larger. Actually, it's a lot larger because those XOR instructions are one byte, or one word, I forgot. But these moves are, you know, contain like the minus one, which is a word by itself, and then the instruction itself and all that bad stuff, right? So completely different code generated. I'm glad this this worked. All right. So to kind of conclude on this particular zero thing, I think I mentioned this in my previous talk that I gave at Microsoft. By mistake, I found it more natural to swap these two values of an enum, and I got a 0.5% regression because everybody was testing against foo. If this equals foo, and this is not, that is foo. If that is different from foo, and all everybody was testing on foo, not on bar. And when I swapped them, foo became one, and everybody was testing against one. And guess what? Guess what? Where the code that was testing was? Where was it?
Everywhere.
In a destructor. I'm not kidding. All right, let me turn back now and kind of continue with the show here. Okay, where were we? A zero special, back. All right, so it's keeping the last decrement. So that's a great thing. Awesome. So you know, we're again motivated by the fact that most objects have low reference counts. So out of how many increments I'm doing on a given counter, it's going to be the last one is going to be maybe half of all increments, right? Because I only have like two references to that guy. So it's actually fractionally speaking, the last decrement is huge, right? I just said that. And one other interesting thing, which comes kind of, it's subtle. I was speaking to Jason Evans, the author of J Malloc, and he said, one of the worst mistakes that people who implement malloc and free do is to keep the metadata with the data. I see a nod from Nevin. Why is the metadata doing that bad?
It's always on the same cache line, so every time you're reading
the metadata. The thing is, when you free, very often you free cold memory. When you call free, like delete, right? When you free stuff, you free very often, it's cold memory. And if you need to write to the metadata, you need to write to the metadata to mark it as free. And at that moment, you are going to write to cold memory. So you're loading that memory, write to it, it's free. And then you dirty the thing. So it's kind of the worst thing ever, right? So you dirty the damn page there, and then you never use it again. And the CPU has no idea that you don't plan to use it again, right? It's completely weird. So a good allocator keeps the metadata separated from the actual payloads, such that when free memory just touches only the metadata, which is, of course, always hot. Fedor, destroy me. Right. Right. So the point was, well, if you have a good mallocator, you're going to use free lists, which are going to take care of that because they're going to reuse that cold memory over again. Well, do you like fragmentation?
No,
the idea was you would say no, and I would say then don't use free lists. That's the way the sketch goes here. Right. No. So, of course. So there's qualifications to everything, right? But as the first level of approximation, essentially, this is an issue with freeing blocks of memory and Let's leave it at that for now. And kind of can destroy me offline, just not in front of everybody, okay? All right, so avoid learning, this is the argument that I just made. And you know, as I said, we want to replace interlock decrement with an atomic read in the variant that would be actually thread shared and not only shared inside the thread, the same thread. So actually the impact of this optimization in particular is huge for shared PTR STD, you know, the guy that does the interlock decrement. Just do an atomic read, and by the way, on x86 that's free because all reads are atomic, right? Thank you. Yes, destroy me, oh my God. Okay, whenever he raises the hand, okay. Okay, because of that weak point, I really kind of, right. Doesn't he grind your gears, huh? Okay, great. So we talked about this, right? Okay, we discussed this guy. All right, I have two smaller tips. It turns out that using dedicated allocators, it's just a fact of life that many large applications inevitably migrate to, like, you know, using their own allocation scheme. General purpose allocators are just not going to cut the mustard. They're going to, you know, they're going to work most of the time for most applications, etc. It's just that for high performance applications, there's always going to be something you can do that malloc doesn't do, right? And dedicated allocators do a lot of good stuff, such as, for example, there's heaps that store one control bit per counter and store metadata packed together, and it's always hot. So I have a very low overhead for small objects. In these cases, we allocate these small UINs all over the place, so we want to allocate them really fast, right? And a really small block allocator can do wonders there. So you can have a very low overhead for a 32-bit counter there. And of course, the metadata is very cache friendly. And you can use freelist that we just talked about as an alternative. You gotta have the disadvantage is each counter has to be a one word because it's gotta store a pointer in it. So it's, you know, you gotta measure and think of it and really be careful about it, right? And the last tip, which is, I mentioned it already a bit, is odd. Actually, I have people like really raising protests here, like, what the hell are you talking about? So the vast majority of objects, as we talked, have less than 16 references. And you can prefer a smaller counter if you can pack it together with something else. And on saturate, you leak, you log, and everything goes forward, right? This blows up the code size. What does it blow up the code size? The logging. Oh, the logging. Okay, awesome. Very nice, very nice. Touche. All right. So to summarize, there's a dictum that we hear very often in the C++ community, which is you're not that special. Many people used to say, well, you know, I know what the coding standards say and whatever, but I'm special and therefore I'm entitled to do all sorts of things. Whatever, you know, whatever the sin was, there was a rationalization for it because you are special, right? And, you know, there's been like a push from the pundits in the C++ community to say, well, actually you're not that special. And actually I remember Scott Myers who had this, like, you're not that special. And think of your case as more of a typical case than the atypical case. I would say nowadays, there's, you know, the brass knuckles are on. Like, whenever you use systems programming in a large application, there's going to be huge pressure for you to deliver on performance. Because otherwise, they do it in Ruby. Code. Did I offend it? Okay, Mike, delete that, okay? Post-processing is going to. So now here's the thing. Code. I heard that this last night. Ruby is 50 times slower than anything else. Which is kind of contradictory when you think of it, because it can be 50 times slower than something that's already like 10 times slower. But it's 50 times slower than anything, which is interesting. And Ruby and higher level languages are a good fit for certain applications. But definitely, by the point you care about this kind of stuff that we just discussed, you can assume you're special. You can assume you're special. You can assume that whatever is standard and given to you and recommended to most of us is not enough. And you gotta kind of get there and kind of really reach for the last ounce of performance and get it, you know, squeeze that stone, okay, until blood comes out of it. All right. Thanks very much. I wanted to finish high with applause on a nice sentence there, but I have 5 minutes for questions. So, there's any? Oh, okay. Don't. This is not questions. Ah, Stefan. Awesome. Yes.
For single-threaded smart pointers, I have heard of linked smart pointers, which the standard says, "Oh yeah, you can use this," but nobody does for stitcher putter because it's multi-threaded. For single-threaded, does that help?
Link smart pointers. So instead of storing an explicit count, you kind of link them together.
Yeah. Some doubly linked list and chain together all the things, and that's your count. Is that?
The doubly linked list is too much of a blow up in size, and the singly linked list is all Venn deletion. So it's between a stone and a hard place. It's not that, you know, it's not that good actually.
Excellent. I will file an issue to make the standard say that use count is efficient.
All right. I guess you can code this recording as evidence. Yes. Yes.
Okay, so we've spent some time doing micro optimizations to reduce slack, to use 0 instead of 1 in comparisons. Does it really make sense when, anyway, we're still doing allocations and deallocations? Does it give us anything, or is it just academic?
An allocation, so I assume the question has been heard. Allocations take you about 150 cycles to get you there. So one allocation takes, like, in a general purpose memory allocator, it's gonna take, you know, it's gonna use all of these good techniques. After all is told, there's gonna be 150 cycles that are gonna. With that, you're not gonna be able to measure any difference by the zero there. Thanks. Questions. Oh, by the way, so kind of to continue on that, there's always, after this talk, there's always somebody who comes, "Actually, I tested that and I had the one, I replaced it with a zero, and I saw no difference whatsoever." Well, you know, cave attemptor, it's not always going to, these are not going to do miracles for you every time, right? Yes?
Some of those things you did, like the choose zero, is pretty specific to the Intel architecture. Others you can use the gatekeeper are not going to do that.
So the question was, some of the stuff is specific to Intel, and how does this advice port to other architectures? I would say maybe, actually, zeros are pretty universally special to CPUs. And in general, like, these tips, in my opinion, port pretty well across modern architectures. So you can be safe that they're going to help. Yes. All right, so let's take the break, and I'll be here for a few more minutes. Thank you very much.